Eleanor Whitmore did not tremble when they read the order aloud. She did not flinch when the lawyer slid the envelope across the mahogany table like she was a bill being settled. She simply looked at it, that thick cream envelope stuffed with more money than her family had seen in a decade, and she pushed it back. The room went silent. If this story moves something in you, subscribe to this channel and follow Eleanor all the way to the end. And tell me what city are you watching from? Drop it in the comments. I want to see how far this story travels. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Summer, 1817. The office of Thornton & Associates occupied the second floor of a narrow brick building on Chestnut Street, wedged between a printer's shop and a counting house that smelled of tallow and old coin. It was the kind of place where fortunes were signed away and futures were decided by men who never raised their voices because they had never needed to. Mr. Caleb Thornton sat behind his desk with both hands folded on top of a leather portfolio, and he had not moved them in 4 minutes. Eleanor Whitmore knew this because she had been counting. It was the only thing keeping her breathing steadily. To her left sat her father, Reginald Whitmore, a man whose posture still carried the memory of wealth his bank account had long since abandoned. He was smiling. That was the worst part. He was smiling the way a man smiles when he believes he has finally, after years of stumbling, made the right deal. And in the far corner of the room, standing with his back to the window so that the summer light fell behind him and left his face in shadow, was Nathaniel Ashford. He had not sat down. He had not greeted anyone. He had walked in 7 minutes after Eleanor and her father arrived, handed his hat to no one because no one had moved fast enough to take it, set it on the corner of Thornton's desk himself, and positioned himself at the window like a man who owned the building, which Eleanor had since learned he actually did. Nathaniel Ashford was 31 years old. He had inherited the Ashford landholdings at 19, tripled them by 25, and was now considered the most consequential private landowner between Philadelphia and the Virginia border. He was not handsome in the easy, pleasant way of the men Eleanor had grown up around. He was sharp. All of him, the jaw, the eyes, the stillness, like something that had been cut rather than grown. He had never looked directly at Eleanor since she entered the room. She told herself that did not bother her. Mr. Thornton cleared his throat. "Miss Whitmore," he said with the careful gentleness of a man delivering a sentence he had rehearsed. "As you are aware, the betrothal agreement between yourself and Mr. Ashford, entered into this past April on behalf of the Whitmore family, has been reviewed." Eleanor kept her hands folded in her lap. "Reviewed," she repeated. "Yes?" Thornton glanced once toward the window. "Mr. Ashford has determined that the arrangement is no longer suitable to proceed." Her father shifted in his chair. The leather creaked. "Entirely understandable," Reginald said, and his voice had that greased, accommodating quality that made Eleanor's stomach tighten. "These things happen. No fault assigned. We are simply grateful for Mr. Ashford's consideration in handling this matter with discretion." Eleanor looked at her father for 3 full seconds. He did not look back at her. She turned back to Thornton. "When was this decision made?" she asked. Thornton blinked. "I beg your pardon. The decision to dissolve the engagement." Her voice was level. Careful. She had spent the carriage ride over deciding what tone to use, and she had settled on level and careful, because it was the only one that would not give anyone in this room anything they could use. "When was it made before or after my father accepted the second installment of the betrothal payment?" The silence that followed was a different kind of silence than the one before. Thornton's hands shifted on the portfolio. Her father went still in a way that was not the same as stillness. It was the freezing of a man caught. From the corner, nothing moved. But Eleanor felt something change in that corner. A shift in attention. The faintest reorientation of weight, as though something that had been pointed away had just turned toward her. "Eleanor," her father said low and warning. "I am simply asking a question," she said pleasantly. "I believe I am owed that much at minimum, given the circumstances." Thornton opened the portfolio. "Miss Whitmore, the terms of dissolution are quite generous. Mr. Ashford has arranged—I would like Mr. Ashford to tell me himself." The words dropped into the room like a stone into still water. Her father made a sound that was not quite a word. Thornton's mouth opened and then closed. And from the corner of the room, for the first time since she had entered it, Nathaniel Ashford moved. He did not come to the desk. He took two steps, just two away from the window, which brought him far enough into the light that she could see his face properly. It was exactly as sharp as it had looked in profile. His eyes were dark and held no particular expression, which Eleanor was beginning to understand was itself an expression. "The decision," he said, "was made 3 weeks ago." His voice was low, not quiet. There was a difference. Quiet was apologetic. Low was simply controlled. "3 weeks ago," Eleanor said, "before the second installment was paid." "Yes." "And yet the payment was made anyway." He said nothing. "I see." She turned back to Thornton. "What exactly is in that portfolio, Mr. Thornton?" Thornton extracted a folded document and a cream envelope and laid them side by side on the desk. "A formal dissolution of the betrothal agreement requiring your signature, and a settlement compensation for any inconvenience the termination of the arrangement may cause your family. Mr. Ashford has been extremely generous. The sum would..." "I don't need the sum explained to me." She looked at the envelope. Then she looked at the document. Then she folded her hands back in her lap and said, "No." Thornton blinked again. He seemed to do a great deal of blinking. "I beg your pardon. I will not sign." Her father turned to her so fast his chair groaned. "Eleanor, I will not sign a document that releases Mr. Ashford of all responsibility for a breach of contract that..." "There was no breach," her father said sharply, dropping the pleasant tone entirely. "The agreement contained exit provisions. Mr. Ashford has followed them to the letter. He owes us nothing beyond what he has already offered." "He owes me an explanation," Eleanor said, and her voice did not rise, but something in it went taut like a wire pulled to its limit. "Because no one in this room has yet addressed the fact that I was not consulted. About the engagement. About the dissolution. About the settlement." She looked at Thornton. "My signature was required to enter this agreement. Is my signature not required to dissolve it?" Thornton looked at his portfolio with the expression of a man who deeply wished he had chosen a different profession. "Technically," he said carefully, "the agreement was entered into between Mr. Ashford and your father as your legal guardian. The dissolution." "Then I would like to speak to Mr. Ashford." She turned and looked directly at him for the first time. "Directly. Without intermediaries." No one spoke. Nathaniel Ashford looked at her. Actually looked for the first time with that dark-eyed attention that had no readable emotion in it, and then he said with no particular emphasis, "Give her whatever she asks, and get her out." The words were addressed to Thornton. He still had not addressed them to her. Something moved through Eleanor's chest. A hot, hollow thing, and she recognized it as the particular humiliation of being spoken about while present. She had felt it before in ballrooms and parlors and her own family's dining room. She had always swallowed it before. She did not swallow it now. "I asked for an explanation," she said clearly. "Not money, not a settlement. An explanation. That is what I want." "Miss Whitmore," Thornton began. "That is what I am asking for," she said, still looking at Nathaniel Ashford. "So, if you are instructing Mr. Thornton to give me whatever I ask, then I am asking for 5 minutes of your time, alone, right now, before I sign anything." The room held its breath. Her father stood up. "Absolutely not. Eleanor, you are embarrassing..." "Sit down, Mr. Whitmore." It was Nathaniel who said it. Reginald Whitmore sat down. Eleanor watched her father sit down at the command of this man's voice, the way he had never once sat down at hers, and she stored that observation somewhere cold and quiet inside herself, to examine later when she was alone. "Thornton," Nathaniel said, "take Mr. Whitmore to the outer office. Offer him something to drink. He looks like he needs it." Thornton was on his feet before the sentence finished. He touched Reginald's arm, murmured something about brandy, and steered him out with the practiced efficiency of a man accustomed to managing difficult situations. The door clicked shut behind them. Eleanor and Nathaniel Ashford were alone. She had wanted this. She had pushed for it deliberately with clear eyes. And still, now that it had happened, the room felt considerably smaller than it had a moment before. He had moved back to his original position near the window. She couldn't tell if it was habit or strategy. 5 minutes, he said. Ask. She asked the most important thing first. Why? He looked at her without any visible discomfort. The arrangement was no longer advantageous. To you? Yes. In what way had it changed? A pause. That is not something I intend to discuss. Then what are you willing to discuss? She asked. Because if I am in this room alone with you and you intend to say nothing of substance, then we may as well have saved everyone the theater of it, and you could have simply had Thornton present me with the document and a pen and informed me that my feelings on the matter were irrelevant. Your feelings on the matter are not irrelevant. Then act like it. He was quiet for a moment that stretched 3 or 4 seconds longer than was comfortable. The arrangement was entered into for financial reasons, he said finally. Your family's debts, my need for social consolidation. That is the plain truth of it. It was a transaction. When the terms of that transaction no longer served both parties equally, I ended it. You ended it, she said. I was not consulted. You were not a party to the original negotiation. I was the subject of it, he said nothing. I was bartered, Eleanor said with perfect evenness, between my father and yourself at a price for purposes neither of you saw fit to explain to me. And when the price became inconvenient, I was discarded. And now I am being offered a settlement to ensure I go quietly. She tilted her head slightly. Tell me, Mr. Ashford, does any part of that strike you as something a person with dignity ought to simply sign and walk away from? The silence that followed was different from all the previous silences. He was looking at her with that same unreadable attention, but there was something behind it now, something she couldn't name. Not guilt, not softness, something more like recalibration. You could take the settlement, he said slowly. It is substantial. It would resolve your family's most pressing debts. It would give you a measure of independence. I did not come here for independence purchased with your money, she said. I came here to be treated as a person who matters. Those are different things. What do you want, then? I already told you, an explanation. A real one. He was quiet for a long moment. Long enough that she thought he might simply walk to the door and end the conversation. Then he said, I was engaged before, 6 years ago. It ended badly. There were consequences. He said it with no particular emotion, the way a man recites a fact from a ledger. I entered your father's arrangement because I required certain social standing, a wife, the appearance of stability. But I found recently that I am not capable of entering an arrangement of that kind again. Not as a transaction. He paused. I am aware that does not explain why you specifically were not consulted. I do not have an answer for that. It did not occur to me. Which is perhaps the most honest thing I have said in this room today. Eleanor looked at him for a long moment. It did not occur to you, she said. No. That is not an apology. I know. But it is honest. Yes. She was quiet. Then she stood slowly, deliberately, and walked to the desk and picked up the settlement envelope. She turned it over once in her hands. Heavy, dense with paper and promise, and the particular weight of money that was meant to buy silence. She set it back down. I will not take the money, she said. I will sign the dissolution because I have no interest in remaining legally entangled with a man who does not see me. But I will not take the settlement. Not $1. He frowned for the first time. It changed his face, made it more human, somehow less carved. That is not rational. The money would... I know what it would do. She picked up her gloves from the arm of the chair and began pulling them on with small, precise movements. It would also tell every person in Philadelphia that I was compensated for my inconvenience, that I was managed, that I accepted what I was given and was grateful for it. She smoothed the first glove over her fingers. I am not available to be managed, Mr. Ashford. That is what I came here to say. I did not know that when I got into the carriage this morning. But I know it now. She walked to the door. Miss Whitmore? She stopped, did not turn immediately, let a breath pass before she looked back. He was still at the window, still in that careful stillness of his. But something in it had shifted, thinned somehow, like a layer had come off without his noticing. For what it is worth, he said, and his voice had dropped to something that was almost not controlled. You were not the problem. The arrangement was. There is a difference. She looked at him for a moment. There is, she agreed. And knowing that changes nothing. But thank you for saying it. She opened the door. Her father was already on his feet in the outer office halfway through what appeared to be a glass of brandy, his face cycling through alarm and relief, and the beginning of the kind of anger that would not surface until they were private. Thornton was looking at her with wide, uncertain eyes. I will sign the dissolution, Eleanor told him. Bring it to our home tomorrow morning. The settlement can be returned to Mr. Ashford. She picked up her hat from the table by the door. Good day, Mr. Thornton. She did not wait to see anyone's expression. She went down the stairs and out onto Chestnut Street, where the summer heat hit her like a held breath finally released, and she stood on the brick sidewalk for exactly 3 seconds. 3 seconds of nothing of the world continuing around her, of her heart knocking hard against her ribs, before she put one foot in front of the other and walked. Behind her, on the second floor of the Ashford building, a man stood at a window. He watched her go, and for the first time in a very long time, Nathaniel Ashford did not know what to do with what he was thinking. The dissolution papers arrived the next morning at 9:30, delivered by a junior clerk from Thornton's office, who could not have been more than 17, and who handed the envelope to Eleanor at the front door, with the careful solemnity of someone who had been told this was important, without being told why. Eleanor signed them at the writing desk in the parlor, while her father ate breakfast in the next room. She could hear him, the clink of his fork, the occasional sound of the newspaper being folded and refolded, the particular quality of silence that meant he was waiting for her to come in and have the conversation he had been building toward since the carriage ride home yesterday. She signed her name cleanly, blotted it, folded the paper back into the envelope, and handed it to the clerk. Tell Mr. Thornton it is done, she said. Yes, ma'am. The boy hesitated. He also asked me to, there was a second envelope, ma'am. He said if you hadn't, return it. Ma'am. Whatever is in the second envelope, return it to Mr. Thornton, or to Mr. Ashford directly. I don't much mind which. She offered him a brief, pleasant smile. Thank you for coming out in this heat. The boy left. Eleanor closed the front door. Then she stood in the hallway for a moment with her hand still on the latch, breathing slowly, listening to the sounds of the house. The creak of her father's chair. The distant clatter of the kitchen. The ordinary, indifferent mourning continuing around the fact that her engagement arranged without her consent and dissolved without her knowledge was now officially legally finished. She had expected to feel something larger. She felt instead something very quiet and very clear. Like the moment after a fever breaks and the world comes back into focus. She went into the breakfast room. Her father looked up from his paper. His expression cycled through several things in rapid succession. Relief, wariness, the rehearsed disappointment of a man who had prepared a speech before settling on something that was trying to be neutral. It is done, he asked. Yes, and the settlement returned. The word landed in the room with a weight that was not proportional to its size. Her father set down his fork. Eleanor. His voice had that particular timbre low controlled the voice he used when he wanted to sound reasonable. And was not feeling reasonable. That money would have, do you understand what that settlement represented? The amount he offered was enough to clear the Hartley debt entirely. Enough to we could have. I know what it was enough for. Then why? Because I am not a debt to be settled. She pulled out the chair across from him and sat. Poured herself coffee with a steady hand. The engagement was a transaction. Entered into without my participation. Dissolved without my participation. The settlement was the final step of that transaction payment in full for the inconvenience of my existence in the arrangement. I declined to complete the transaction. She looked up at him. It was, in fact, the only part of this entire situation over which I had any agency whatsoever. I used it. Her father stared at her. Then he said very quietly, "You are making things extremely difficult." "Yes," she agreed. "I imagine I am." The silence between them stretched long and uncomfortable, and her father finally picked up his fork again, which she recognized as his way of ending a conversation he had not won. Eleanor drank her coffee and said nothing else. But the quiet in that room did not stay quiet for long. By afternoon, Philadelphia had talked. She did not know how it spread so fast. She never did with these things. But by the time Mrs. Alderton's daughter came calling at 3 o'clock, with the thin pretense of returning a borrowed book, Eleanor could tell from the girl's careful eyes and careful smile that the story had already moved through at least 2 parlors and 1 church social. "We were so sorry to hear," the girl said with a sympathy so perfectly calibrated it was almost artful, "about the arrangement. It must be terribly disappointing." "Not particularly," Eleanor said. The girl blinked. "I pardon. I am not particularly disappointed." Eleanor refilled the girl's tea. "Would you like more sugar?" Yes, thank you. But surely that is... Mr. Ashford is everyone had expected. People often expect things that don't come to pass. Eleanor set down the sugar bowl. "I find it rarely serves anyone to spend much energy on expectations, particularly other people's." The girl left 20 minutes later with a slightly bewildered expression, the borrowed book still under her arm, and Eleanor sat alone in the parlor and listened to the sound of carriage wheels on the street outside and understood with perfect clarity that the next few weeks were going to require something of her that she was not entirely certain she possessed in sufficient quantity. Because the thing about Philadelphia in 1817 was this: a woman who had been discarded from an engagement was not simply a woman whose plans had changed. She was a woman about whom conclusions had been drawn. The conclusions varied depending on who was drawing them, but they converged with the tidy efficiency of social logic on a single point. She had been found wanting. Something in her had been examined and declined. Eleanor had known this was coming. She had known it in the carriage ride home, and she had known it when she lay awake the night before, listening to the house settle around her. She had known it, and she had signed the papers anyway, and returned the money anyway, because the alternative, accepting the settlement wearing the careful, grateful expression of a woman who had been managed and was thankful for it, was something her body would not do. But knowing a thing is coming and feeling it arrive are different experiences entirely. She felt it arrive over the next 4 days in the particular quality of greetings on the street, a fraction too warm, a fraction too careful. The warmth of people who feel sorry for you and want you to know they feel sorry while also wanting you to know they would never have made the choices that put you here. She felt it in the way the conversation shifted at the Mercer dinner party, 2 evenings after the signing, when she walked into the main room and something moved through the assembled guests, like a current, a small collective reorientation, a communal decision made in the space of 2 seconds about how she was to be treated tonight. She stood in the doorway of the Mercer's dining room, in her best summer gown, ivory with blue ribbon trim, pressed carefully, because Eleanor had learned long ago that appearance was one of the few things she could control, and she felt 30 people make that calculation, and she smiled at the nearest face and walked in. It was Mrs. Harriet Beaumont who said it plainly, which was both the worst and best version of events, because Mrs. Beaumont was at least honest about what she was doing. "My dear," she said, intercepting Eleanor near the fireplace with a hand on her arm and a voice pitched low enough to seem confidential, but loud enough to be heard by the 4 people immediately adjacent. "You poor thing. We all feel for you truly. It is difficult at your age to start again. But I'm sure the right sort of man, a more appropriate match, will present himself in time." At your age, Eleanor was 22. She looked at Harriet Beaumont for a long moment. The woman's face was arranged in an expression of such elaborate compassion that it had looped back around to something that resembled satisfaction. "How kind," Eleanor said. "Tell me, Mrs. Beaumont, how is your son settling into his new position? The one in the counting house your husband arranged for him, the one he applied for 2x before being accepted?" She smiled warmly. I'm sure it is difficult at his age to find his footing, but I'm certain the right sort of opportunity will present itself in time. Mrs. Beaumont's face did something complicated. Someone nearby made a sound that was not quite a cough. Eleanor excused herself gracefully and went to find someone worth talking to. She found instead Mr. Caleb Thornton. He was standing near the windows with a glass of something amber, and he had the expression of a man who had not expected to see her here and was rapidly revising several assumptions. He straightened when she approached. "Miss Whitmore," he said. "Mr. Thornton." She stopped beside him, facing the room rather than him, which had the practical advantage of making the conversation look casual. "The papers have been filed." "Yes, as of this morning." He hesitated. "The settlement was, Mr. Ashford was informed of your refusal." "Good." Another hesitation. "He was, I will say, Miss Whitmore, that his response was not what I expected." She kept her voice light. "And what was his response?" "He asked me if you had given a reason." "What did you tell him?" "That you had said you were not available to be managed." Thornton's voice carried a note of something she couldn't quite place. Not admiration exactly, but something adjacent. He was quiet for some time after that. Eleanor considered this. "I see," she said finally. And then, "He told me to ensure the dissolution was processed correctly and that you received confirmation of completion." Thornton paused. "He also asked, and I confess, I did not know what to make of this, whether your family's financial situation had been adequately addressed by other means, whether you would have what you needed." Eleanor turned to look at him directly for the first time. "He asked that?" "He did." She was quiet. "You may tell him," she said carefully, "that my family's financial situation is my family's business, and that his concern, though noted, is not required." Thornton nodded. She could not tell if he was relieved or troubled by this answer. Possibly both. She excused herself and moved on through the party, and she did not think about what Thornton had told her, not about Nathaniel Ashford standing in some quiet room asking whether she would have what she needed until she was home and alone. And then she thought about it only briefly, and then she put it away. It was the wrong thing to think about. The right things to think about were practical, were immediate, were the three letters she needed to write in the morning, and the question of whether the Whitmore household could sustain itself through the end of summer without the financial supplement the engagement had implied would be coming. Were the look on her father's face at dinner that evening that particular mixture of resentment and helplessness that she had grown up with, that she now recognized as the face of a man who has run out of strategies and is waiting for someone else to produce one? "Mr. Harding came today," her father said without looking up from his soup. Eleanor kept her expression even. Mr. Harding was the family's primary creditor. And he was understanding. A pause. "He mentioned that the Ashford name, had it been attached to our accounts, would have provided certain latitude. That without that connection, the terms of our existing arrangements may need to be revisited." "How revisited?" "The Hartley note comes due at the end of September." Eleanor did the arithmetic in her head. September was 8 weeks away. "How much?" she asked. Her father finally looked up. "More than we have." The words sat on the table between them like a third place setting, unwelcome and unavoidable. Eleanor set down her fork. "I see," she said. "If you had taken the settlement," her father began. "I did not take the settlement." "Eleanor, I did not take it, and I will not revisit that decision." She picked up her fork again. "We will find another way. There is no other way that does not involve connections we no longer have, or assets we no longer—" "Then we will find a way we haven't thought of yet." She met his eyes. "Eat your dinner, father." He stared at her. Then, with the deflated resignation of a man who has recognized he is not going to win this argument tonight, he looked back down at his plate. Eleanor ate her dinner. But her mind was already moving, already turning over the problem with the methodical focus that had always been. She was privately aware her most useful quality, and the one least appreciated by the people around her. She had a good mind. She always had. It had simply never been pointed at anything that mattered because the trajectory of her life had been designed to run through a husband's decisions rather than her own. Well, that design had come apart. Something else would have to be built. The next morning, she went to see her mother's cousin, Mrs. Dorothea Price. Dorothea Price was 63 years old, had been widowed twice, and occupied a narrow house on Pine Street that she had purchased herself with money she had inherited from her second husband, and subsequently tripled through a series of lending arrangements that polite Philadelphia considered vaguely improper and that Dorothea considered simply efficient. She had always made Eleanor feel as though her brain was being taken seriously, which was rare enough that Eleanor had been loyal to her since childhood. "You refuse the money," Dorothea said before Eleanor had fully sat down. "How did you hear already?" "Thornton plays cards with my nephew." Dorothea waved a hand. "Sit down. I heard you refused everything, the settlement, the discussion, the whole managed little performance of it. Is that accurate?" "More or less." "Good." Dorothea poured two cups of tea without asking and pushed one across. "I was afraid you'd take it. I was afraid you'd be sensible." Eleanor looked at her. "Most people are telling me I wasn't sensible." "Most people are idiots about money." Dorothea settled back in her chair. "Taking that settlement would have purchased your silence. Do you understand that? Not your independence. Not your comfort. Your silence. There is a difference." "Yes," Eleanor said. "That is what I understood." "Good. Now," Dorothea folded her hands, "your father's debts. You heard about those too." "I have ears, child. Tell me the numbers," Eleanor told her. Dorothea listened without interrupting, which was itself a kind of gift. Most people listened in order to respond, not in order to actually hear. When Eleanor finished, the older woman was quiet for a moment, her eyes on the window. "It is manageable," she said finally. "Not easily, but manageable." "How?" "I have a property on Market Street, a commercial property currently leased to a milliner who is moving to New York in October. The space will be vacant." She looked at Eleanor. "I am considering what to do with it. I would be willing to discuss terms for a sublease at a considerably reduced rate if the right person had a use for it." Eleanor went still. "What kind of use?" she asked carefully. "That depends on what you know how to do." Dorothea tilted her head. "What do you know how to do?" Eleanor thought of the letter she wrote for her father, the correspondence he handed off to her because she organized things more clearly than he did, the accounts she had quietly corrected twice when his bookkeeper had made errors, the contract she had read line by line the night before the meeting at Thornton's office, understanding every clause, while no one had asked her if she understood any of them. "I can read a contract," she said. "I can write one. I can manage correspondence. I understand accounts well enough to..." "Can you teach?" Dorothea interrupted. "Teach what?" "Reading, writing, basic correspondence and account keeping. For women." Dorothea leaned forward. "There are women in this city. Eleanor wives, daughters, widows, who handle their household's daily affairs and have no formal training for it. Who sign things they do not understand because no one has ever taught them to understand. Who need exactly the sort of mind you have and are not told they are allowed to want it." She paused. "I have been thinking about this for some time. I have not had the right person to think about it with." Eleanor looked at her. Something in her chest that had been clenched since yesterday morning, since before that, since the carriage ride to Thornton's office, since the months of the engagement, during which she had been a figure in someone else's transaction, began very carefully to loosen. "That is not a respectable thing for a woman of my station to do," she said slowly. "No," Dorothea agreed. "It is not. My father would object. Strenuously, I would imagine. And society would say precisely what it is already saying. That you are a woman whose engagement fell through and who is making the best of difficult circumstances." Dorothea raised an eyebrow. "The difference is that you would be making the best of difficult circumstances, actually, on your own terms." Eleanor was quiet. "Tell me about the property," she said. She was there for 2 hours. By the time she left Dorothea's house, the summer heat had built to its full midday weight, and Eleanor walked home through streets full of the ordinary noise of Philadelphia vendors and carriages and the distant sound of a church bell, with something in her body that she only gradually recognized as forward motion. Not hope exactly. Something more practical than hope. Direction. She was 3 blocks from home when the carriage pulled alongside her. She knew whose it was before she looked up. She did not know how she knew something in the quality of the pause, the way it slowed to match her pace, rather than stopping abruptly. But she knew, and she kept walking, and she did not look at the window. "Miss Whitmore." The voice came from inside the carriage, low, controlled, the same as she remembered. She stopped walking. She turned. Nathaniel Ashford's carriage was dark green with brass fittings and the Ashford crest on the door in restrained gold, and he was seated inside it with his hat on his knee and his eyes on her with that same unreadable attention that she had spent 4 days trying not to think about. "Mr. Ashford," she said, "may I offer you a ride?" "No." "Then may I speak with you briefly?" She looked at him for a moment. The street was busy enough that no one was paying them particular attention, which was either fortunate or unfortunate, depending on how you calculated these things. "You may speak," she said. "Briefly." He leaned slightly toward the open window. "I heard that Harding came to see your father." The careful composure she had been carrying since Dorothea's tightened just barely. "That is not your concern. I made it difficult for you," he said. "The dissolution, the timing of it. I am aware that it had financial consequences that—" "Mr. Ashford." Her voice was even. "I am going to say this very clearly because I don't wish to have this conversation more than once. You did not ruin my prospects. My prospects were not mine to begin with. They were constructed by other people, for other people's purposes, and they have now been unconstructed, and that is simply the situation I am in. I am managing it. I do not need your assistance in managing it." He looked at her. "You returned the settlement." "I did." "Why?" "I explained this to you already." "You explained the principle," he said. "I understood the principle. I am asking why you specifically, as a woman in your specific situation, chose the principle over the practical resolution." She considered him for a long moment. "Because," she said finally, "if I had taken the money, I would have spent the rest of my life knowing that the first time it mattered, I traded myself for convenience. And that is not something I can unknow once I know it." She paused. "The same way you cannot unknow that you entered an engagement with a woman you had never had a real conversation with and dissolved it without telling her. You know that now. You will continue to know it." The silence that followed was long. "Yes," he said, "I will." Something shifted in the air between them, not warmth, not precisely, but something honest, something that didn't require performance. "I am not in need of rescue, Mr. Ashford," she said, "if that is what you are offering." "It isn't," he said. And then after a pause, "I don't know what I'm offering. I haven't decided." She blinked. It was the most unexpectedly plain thing she had heard him say. "That is an honest answer," she said slowly. "You seem to respond well to honest answers." "I do." He nodded once, settled back slightly. "Then I will tell you honestly that I asked Thornton how your situation stood, and he did not tell me, and I have been occupied with that not knowing in a way that is not typical for me." She looked at him. "Occupied how?" "Thinking about it," he said with the faint expression of a man annoyed by his own admission, "more than is sensible." Eleanor looked at him, this sharp, guarded man in his expensive carriage, who was telling her in as roundabout a way as language permitted that she had stuck in his mind, and she felt something she was not going to name. Not yet, not standing on a public street in the full midday sun, with her gloves damp at the fingertips. "Good day, Mr. Ashford," she said. She turned and walked home, and she did not allow herself to look back, but she was aware in the back of her neck, in the particular way the air moves when someone is still watching, that the carriage had not yet moved by the time she reached the corner. She turned it and walked on, and kept the thing she was not naming carefully in the back of her mind. Not to examine it, not yet, but simply to keep track of it, as she went inside and sat down at her writing desk, and began composing the first letter to Dorothea about the property on Market Street. She would figure out one thing at a time. Right now, the one thing was this. The other thing, whatever it was, could wait. It would have to. The letter from Dorothea arrived on a Tuesday, 3 days after Eleanor had sent her own, and it contained two things: a proposed lease agreement for the Market Street property, written in Dorothea's precise, unadorned hand, and a single additional line at the bottom that read, "I have spoken to four women already who would come. Do not make me wait long for your answer." Eleanor read it twice at her writing desk, then folded it, and put it in the locked drawer, where she kept the things that mattered. She had not told her father about the property yet. She was building toward it. Constructing the conversation in her mind, the way you construct a bridge, testing the weight of each plank before you set it, making sure the foundation could hold what she intended to put on it. Her father was not a cruel man. He was a frightened one, which was sometimes harder to manage because frightened men could not always be reasoned with, and could not always be comforted, and often mistook their own fear for wisdom. She was still building toward it when the second thing happened. She was at the market on Wednesday morning, actually there herself, because the household had let two of the three servants go in the past month, and Eleanor had quietly taken on the morning errands without announcing she was doing so, because announcement would have required a conversation she did not have the energy for when she heard her name spoken by someone who did not know she was within earshot. "Whitmore girl. Poor creature." She did not slow her pace. She selected a bunch of early summer carrots with her eyes down and her expression undisturbed. "Did you hear what she did? Refused the settlement entirely. Every penny." "Refused it." A second voice higher with that particular note of delighted disbelief. "Why on earth?" "Pride, I expect. Or foolishness. At her age, with her family's situation, to throw away that kind of money, out of what spite? They say Ashford wasn't even the one who ended it. That it was her father who..." "No, wait, I heard it differently. I heard Ashford took one look at her at the signing, and..." Eleanor set down the carrots and turned. The two women, she knew them both by sight, wives of merchants her father had once done business with, went silent in the way of people caught in the specific act of being unkind. "Good morning," Eleanor said pleasantly. "I couldn't help but overhear. I want to make sure the story is accurate since it concerns me." She smiled at the first one. "The settlement was refused because I declined to be compensated for the inconvenience of my own existence in an arrangement I didn't choose. Not out of spite. Not out of foolishness." She looked at the second. "And Mr. Ashford did not take one look at me in anything. He made a business decision, as people do." She picked the carrots back up. "I hope that clarifies things. Have a lovely morning." She walked to the next stall. Her hands were steady. Her face was steady. Something behind her sternum was not steady, but it was hers, and it was private, and she did not owe anyone access to it. She was at the bread stall when she felt the specific sensation of being watched. Not the casual glance of strangers, but something more deliberate, more sustained, and she turned without fully deciding to, and found herself looking across the market square at Nathaniel Ashford. He was standing beside a large bay horse speaking to a man who appeared to be showing him something in a ledger, but his eyes were on Eleanor. He had clearly been watching for some time, because he did not startle when she met his gaze. He simply held it. The way he held everything. Steadily, with that unreadable quality that she was beginning to suspect was not the absence of expression, but the containment of it. She looked at him for exactly 3 seconds. Then she looked back at the bread seller and asked for a whole loaf. When she left the market, the bay horse and its owner were gone. She told herself she had not looked for them. She was 2 days away from signing the agreement with Dorothea when the visit happened. She was alone in the parlor. Her father had gone to see Harding about the September note. A meeting Eleanor had quietly helped him prepare for by drafting 3 possible responses to 3 possible positions Harding might take, which her father had read carefully and said nothing about when the knock came at the front door. Eleanor answered it herself because there was no one else to answer it. Nathaniel Ashford stood on the front step. He was not in traveling clothes. He was not in formal clothes. He was in the ordinary clothes of a man who has been working dark coat. No adornment, the kind of dress that said he had come from somewhere practical and was going somewhere practical and had detoured here in between. He held his hat in his hand. Eleanor looked at him. "Mr. Ashford," she said. "Miss Whitmore." He paused. "May I come in?" She should have said no. She understood that clearly in the part of her mind that tracked the social mathematics of her situation. A dissolved engagement. An unchaperoned house. A man on the doorstep in working clothes. Every calculation ran the same direction. She stepped back and opened the door wider. He came in. She led him to the parlor and did not offer tea, which was deliberate. Tea implied a visit of some length. She did not yet know what this was. "Sit down," she said. He sat. She sat across from him. The summer light was strong through the window, and it made his face easier to read than it had been in Thornton's office, where the shadow had worked in his favor. Here she could see the small tension around his eyes. The controlled quality of his stillness that was, she was more certain now than before, a thing he maintained deliberately and at some effort. "You were at the market yesterday," he said. "Yes." "I heard what you said to those women." She waited. "I owe you." He stopped, started again. "The situation you are in is partly of my making. The dissolution was handled in a way that..." "Mr. Ashford," she kept her voice even, "if you have come to apologize again, I will tell you the same thing I told you from the street. I am managing. I do not require..." "I have not come to apologize," he said. She stopped. "I have come," he said, "because I cannot stop thinking about what you said to me, in Thornton's office, and from the street, and I have tried for 11 days to stop thinking about it, and I cannot, and I am not accustomed to being unable to stop thinking about something, and I would like to understand why." The room was very quiet. "Which part?" she asked. "The part where you said you would not be invisible again." He looked at her directly with that dark, steady gaze. "You said when I told you that you were supposed to take the settlement you said and become invisible again, I want to know what that meant. What made you invisible, before me?" Eleanor looked at him for a long moment. "That is a very personal question," she said. "Yes. You have not earned a very personal answer." "I know." He did not look away. "I am asking anyway." She was quiet. She looked at her hands in her lap, at the good gloves she kept carefully, because there was no money for new ones, at the ring finger of her left hand that was bare. In a way, it had not been bare 3 weeks ago, when the engagement was still a fact. "My whole life," she said slowly, "I have been in rooms where decisions were being made that concerned me. About my education, my future, my value as a potential wife, my family's financial arrangements. I have been in those rooms, and I have understood everything being said in them, and I have never once been asked for my opinion." She looked up. "Not because anyone thought I was stupid. I don't think that. I think they simply didn't think. I was furniture in those rooms. Relevant furniture, the furniture the whole arrangement depended on, but furniture." She paused. "When you said give her whatever she asks and get her out, I understood that nothing had changed. I was still furniture. I was simply being moved to a different room." Nathaniel was very still. "I did not mean it that way," he said. "I know you didn't." Her voice was not unkind. "That is almost worse." He absorbed that. She watched him absorb it, watched something work behind his eyes that was not his usual controlled stillness, but something more uncomfortable, more alive. "The woman I was engaged to before," he said. "Her name was Catherine." Eleanor did not move. "She was 20 when we were engaged. I was 23. It was also arranged. Everything is arranged in our world at our station." "But she was not like you. She was very quiet. Very..." He stopped. "I did not know her. I made no effort to know her. I was busy. I was managing the land transfer, the consolidation, the half-dozen things my father had left unfinished when he died. I told myself there would be time later." A pause. "There was not time later." "What happened?" Eleanor asked quietly. She was with child by the end of the first year. His voice was controlled, but stripped of everything that wasn't essential. She did not tell me she was frightened. She did not tell me she was that things were not right. I was not the sort of man she felt she could tell. I had not made myself that sort of man. He looked at the window. She died in the spring of 1814. The child also. The silence was absolute. Eleanor sat with it. Did not fill it. Did not reach for the easy comforts that language offered in moments like this. The, I'm so sorry, and the it wasn't your fault that were sometimes true and sometimes not, and that a man like this would know the difference between, you blame yourself, she said finally. Yes. For which part? He looked back at her. For not knowing her. For not making it possible for her to be known. For entering an arrangement that was supposed to be that I treated as a transaction, and was not a transaction, because she was a person, and I did not act as though she was. He paused. I have thought about this for 3 years. And then your father came to me with the proposal, and I thought it is the same arrangement. I can manage it. I am older. I know better. He stopped. And then you walked into Thornton's office and said, I am not available to be managed, and I understood that I did not know better at all. I had simply found another way to repeat it. Eleanor looked at him. She felt with great clarity the weight of what he had just given her, not as a gift, as a truth handed over with both hands, with nothing kept back at considerable cost to his own composure. The kind of truth that takes a long time to say, and that you cannot unsay once it is spoken. You are not responsible for her death, Eleanor said carefully. You may be responsible for the distance between you, but the outcome that was not something you chose.
I chose not to choose, he said, which is its own kind of choice.
Yes, she said, it is. He looked at her. Something in his face shifted, not softness exactly, but the thing that happens when a person has been carrying weight for a long time, and someone finally looks at the weight without flinching. You are not what I expected, he said. What did you expect? A woman in a difficult situation, who would either weep or perform not weeping. The corner of his mouth moved the closest thing to wry she had seen from him. You did neither. I wept, she said honestly, at home, by myself, quite thoroughly. Something crossed his face that was almost warmth. Good, he said, surprising her. You should. You didn't. He was quiet for a moment. That is not something I know how to do. I know, she said. And then, before she could stop herself, it shows. He looked at her sharply. She held his gaze without apology. That is... He started, stopped. That is an uncomfortable thing to be told. Most useful things are. He stared at her, and then slowly, reluctantly, with the expression of a man who cannot quite prevent something from happening, he let out a breath that was almost a sound. Not quite a laugh, something smaller than that. But in the vicinity, Eleanor watched it happen and understood something she had not fully understood before, that this man, under all that controlled and cultivated stillness, had a dry and buried sense of humor that he had not used in some time, and that it had surprised him slightly to feel it stir. I came, he said, recovering himself, because I wanted to ask you something. Then ask. What are you planning to do about your situation? She looked at him steadily. Why? Because I would like to know, not to interfere. He said the last part with the particular emphasis of someone who has anticipated the objection. Simply to know. Because the question of what you intend to do with your situation is something I am apparently incapable of not thinking about, and it would help me to have an actual answer, rather than continuing to speculate. Eleanor considered this. She thought about Dorothea's letter in the locked drawer, the property on Market Street, the four women who were already waiting. She thought about telling him, thought about what his face would do with the information a woman of her station taking a lease teaching correspondence and account keeping to other women in a space that was hers. She told him plainly, and without softening it, and without watching his expression while she spoke. Because she did not want to calibrate what she said to what she thought he could receive, she wanted to say it straight and let him receive it however he could.
When she finished, the room was quiet. "That is not," he said carefully, "a conventional plan."
"No."
"Your father knows. Not yet." He was quiet for a moment. "What will he say?" Something between horrified and furious. She smoothed a non-existent wrinkle from her skirt.
"I am preparing for both."
"And if he refuses to allow it?" She looked up.
"He cannot refuse it. I am 22 years old, unmarried.
Not his ward in any legal sense that applies to this situation. He can object, strenuously, he will." She paused.
"But he cannot stop me."
Nathaniel looked at her with an expression she could not fully catalog, not the unreadable blankness of their first meeting, not the careful control of the carriage conversation, but something more present than both, more attentive. "You have thought this through," he said. "I've had 11 days of not being engaged to do very little else," she said. "One uses the time." This time, the almost laugh was less small. "Miss Whitmore," he said, and his voice had dropped to something that was less formal than anything she had heard from him. I would like to offer something, not money, not settlement, something different." She waited.
"I have legal and financial connections in this city that you do not have and that would take you considerably longer to build than you have time for before September."
He held her gaze. "I am not in a position to give your father's creditors money without you knowing about it and refusing it, but I am in a position to make introductions, to speak to certain people whose lending practices are more flexible, who would respond to my recommendation in ways they would not respond to your father walking in alone." Eleanor was very still.
"Why?"
she asked.
"I told you, I made this situation more difficult."
"That is a reason to feel guilty," she said. "It is not a reason to act. What is the real reason?" He held her gaze.
"Because," he said slowly, "you are doing something that I have not seen anyone do in a considerable time. You are refusing to be what the situation demands you be, and you are building something instead."
A pause.
I do not have a word for what I would like to do. Be adjacent to it, perhaps. Watch it develop."
He stopped.
I am aware that sounds strange," she supplied.
"Yes.
And slightly like you are asking for something in return for the introductions."
He looked startled, genuinely startled the first time she had seen his composure catch.
"I know," she said.
"But you should be aware that is how it sounds, so that you can find better language for it." She tilted her head.
"What are you actually asking?"
He was quiet for a long moment.
"I am asking," he said finally, "if you would be willing to continue this. The talking. Like this. Plainly."
He said the word plainly with the slight weight of a man who has spent his life in a world where plain speech is considered a liability and has recently discovered it is not.
"Not as an arrangement. Not as anything with terms. Just continue."
Eleanor looked at him.
"You want to talk to me?" she said.
"Yes."
"That is the whole request."
"Yes."
She held the silence for a moment. Not to make him wait, she was past performing disinterest, but because it was a genuine moment and it deserved a genuine pause.
"I am going to sign the Market Street agreement on Friday," she said.
"I am going to tell my father on Thursday evening.
If you want to be useful with the Harding situation, the window for useful is between now and the end of September."
She met his eyes.
"And yes, you may come back and talk plainly.
On the condition that you do not tell me what to do about anything."
"Agreed," he said without hesitation.
"And that you do not use whatever this is,"
she gestured slightly between them, "as a reason to revisit the question of the settlement."
"Agreed."
"And that if I tell you a plan of mine is none of your business, you accept that answer." He paused for half a second, the half second of a man calculating whether this was a condition he could actually meet. Then, "Agreed."
She nodded.
He stood, which she had not expected yet. She had thought there was more, that this was still building. But he stood and settled his hat in his hand, and looked at her with that gaze that had no name, but had stopped being unreadable.
"Friday," he said.
"Good luck with your father."
"Thursday,"
she corrected. The good luck part is Thursday. He nodded, moved toward the door, stopped in the doorway. Miss Whitmore. He turned back. For what it is worth, and I recognize it may not be worth much, I think what you are doing is I think Catherine would have... He stopped, tried again. I think it is right, what you are doing. I think it is the right thing. Eleanor looked at him across the parlor. Thank you, she said, for telling me about her. He held her gaze for one moment more, then he put on his hat and left. Eleanor sat in the parlor without moving for a long time after the front door closed. The summer heat pressed against the windows. From the street came the ordinary sounds of a Wednesday afternoon horses, voices, the far-off ring of a church bell counting 3 o'clock. She was aware that something had shifted. Not dramatically. Not with the clean narrative clarity of a story. There was no moment she could point to and say there that is where it changed. It was subtler than that. It was the accumulated weight of several conversations that had been unexpectedly honest. It was the fact that he had told her about Catherine without being asked, and she had not run from it, and neither had he. It was the fact that she had told him about Market Street, and he had not tried to manage it, or diminish it, or offer to do it better himself. It was, Eleanor thought, the unfamiliar feeling of being in a room with a man, and having the room feel smaller, yes, but not in the way rooms had always felt smaller when men were in them. Not the compression of available space. Something more like concentration. Like the room had become more real. She sat with that for another few minutes. Then she went to the locked drawer, took out Dorothea's letter, and began drafting her reply. She had a lease to sign on Friday. She had a conversation with her father to survive on Thursday. And somewhere between those two things, she had apparently agreed to let Nathaniel Ashford come back and talk plainly about nothing in particular. She was not sure what any of it was becoming. But for the first time since she had pushed that envelope back across Thornton's desk and walked out into the Philadelphia summer with nothing but the decision itself in her hands, she found that she did not need to be sure. She wrote, Thursday came the way difficult things always come too fast, and without sufficient warning, despite Eleanor having had all week to prepare for it. She told her father after dinner. She had chosen the timing deliberately after the meal, when the table was cleared, and the candles were low, and her father was in the particular state of mild satisfaction that followed a decent evening before he had retreated to his study, with his papers and his private worrying. She wanted him present. She wanted him to have no immediate escape. She sat across from him, and she said it plainly. I am taking a lease on a commercial property on Market Street. I will be opening a correspondence and account school for women. The first session begins in 3 weeks. I have already secured 4 students and expect more. Her father stared at her. The silence lasted long enough that Eleanor counted 8 heartbeats. Then he said very quietly, No. It is not a request, she said. Eleanor. He set his hands flat on the table. You are a Whitmore. Whatever our current difficulties, you are still a woman of your station, does not open a school, does not take a lease, does not what, she said, does not support her own household, does not use the only skills she has in the only way available to her. She held his gaze steadily. Father, the Hartley note comes due in 6 weeks. We have had this conversation. We know what we have and what we do not have. I am offering a solution. That solution will destroy what remains of our reputation. Our reputation, she said, is currently that of a family whose daughter was dismissed from an engagement that her father arranged without her knowledge. I am not certain there is so much left to protect that I should sacrifice a practical path forward to preserve it. Her father's face went through several things: anger, shame, the particular helplessness of a man whose arguments are running out. I will not allow. You cannot stop me, she said. Not unkindly, not triumphantly, simply as a fact. I am 22. The lease is between myself and Dorothea Price. You have no legal standing to prevent it. She paused. What I am asking for, the only thing I am asking for, is that you do not make this more difficult than it needs to be. That you allow me to solve the problem we are both in without adding the obstacle of your objection to everything else I am already managing. The candle between them guttered in a draft from somewhere. Her father looked old. That was the thing she had not let herself see in a while, how old he looked, how tired, how much of the posture and the manner and the careful performance of a Whitmore of standing was costing him in the currency of what was underneath it.
"You sound like your mother," he said finally. His voice had lost the argument tone. What remained was something quieter and more worn.
Eleanor had not expected that. She was quiet for a moment.
Was that meant as a criticism?
He looked at the table.
No.
A long pause. She would have done something like this. If things had been different. If the world had... He stopped. She was wasted on the life we had. I always knew that. I did nothing about it.
He looked up and his eyes were tired in a way that had nothing to do with the hour.
I did the same to you. I know that.
Eleanor did not speak. She did not trust what would come out if she did.
Sign your lease, her father said.
He stood slowly with the stiffness of a man whose joints have been carrying too much for too long.
I will not object. I cannot.
He shook his head.
I cannot pretend to approve of something I do not understand, but I will not stand in your way.
He left the room. Eleanor sat alone at the dinner table for a long time. She had won. She had done the thing she came to do. And yet, what she felt was not victory, it was something more complicated and less comfortable, something that lived in the same place as the conversation about her mother, about a woman wasted on the life available to her. And Eleanor sat with that for a while and understood that she was fighting not just for herself, but for something older than herself, something that had needed fighting for a long time before she arrived. She signed the Market Street lease on Friday morning. Dorothea stood beside her at the solicitor's desk and said nothing, while Eleanor read the document, actually read it every clause, the way she had read the dissolution papers, and then signed her name in the clean, deliberate hand she had developed over years of writing correspondence for a man who never said thank you for it.
Well, Dorothea said, when the solicitor had witnessed and filed and excused himself with the careful discretion of a man who knew he was in the room with something that mattered.
Well,
Eleanor agreed. Dorothea put a hand briefly on Eleanor's arm. Said nothing else. That was the thing about Dorothea. She knew when a moment needed words and when it needed to be left alone. They went out into the Friday morning together, and Eleanor felt the lease like a physical weight in her bag, solid, real, irreversible, and she found that she did not want to put it down. Nathaniel came that afternoon. She had not been certain he would. He had said he would come back, and she had believed him in the moment, but there was a distance between intention and action that many men occupied comfortably and without apparent discomfort, and she had not allowed herself to expect. But the knock came at 2:30, and it was him. He was in working clothes again. He seemed to default to them, which told her something about how he spent his days that the formal attire of their first meeting had obscured. He looked at her face when she opened the door and said, "It went well, the lease?"
"It is signed," she said.
"Come in."
He came in.
This time she offered tea because this was a different kind of visit, and she felt the difference, and she thought he did too. He took it. They sat in the parlor again, but it was not the same parlor it had been 3 days ago, or rather, it was. But they were different people, sitting in it, in some incremental and hard-to-name way.
"Your father?" he asked.
He did not object, in the end. She paused. "He said I sounded like my mother."
Nathaniel looked at her.
What did that mean?
That she would have done the same thing, I think, if she had been allowed.
Eleanor set down her cup. He said she was wasted on the life they had. He said he knew it and did nothing. She was quiet for a moment.
I do not know what to do with that. It is both too late and exactly on time, depending on how you look at it.
Too late for her, he said.
On time for you. She looked up. He said it so plainly without any particular effort at comfort, just the simple precision of it, and she found it was more settling than comfort would have been.
Yes, she said.
That is exactly it.
He nodded,
drank his tea, and then with the air of a man transitioning to business,
Because business is safer than what was just said, I spoke to James Alcott this morning. She placed the name after a moment. The merchant lender. He is willing to restructure the terms of your father's Hartley note. Extended repayment, lower quarterly interest, no penalty for the September date provided a formal arrangement is signed before the end of August. He met her eyes. He will do this as a courtesy to me. I want you to know that plainly, so you can decide what to do with it. Eleanor was quiet. This was the thing she had told him she would not accept assistance interference, the settlement in different clothing. She felt the refusal forming in her throat, and she also felt underneath it the arithmetic of September. The Hartley note, her father's tired face at the dinner table last night. The lease she had just signed with its quarterly payments that would not begin generating income for at least 6 weeks. She looked at him. What does Alcott want in return for the courtesy? Nothing from you. I am the one who owes him a favor now. He paused. I would like to be clear that I did not do this to put you in my debt. I did it because it was a problem with a solution, and I had the solution available. You did it without asking me first. Yes. He held her gaze. I did. I recognized afterward that I should have asked first. I am telling you now so that you can refuse it if you choose to, and I will go back to Alcott and tell him the arrangement is not needed, and there will be no consequences either way. Eleanor sat with this. He had acted without asking. He had then come to tell her he had acted, which he did not have to do. He could simply have arranged it quietly, and never mentioned it, and let it take effect invisibly, the way men of his station manage things for women in their orbit, without announcement, without accountability. He had not done that. She did not know entirely what to do with the fact that he kept doing things she did not expect. I will not refuse it, she said finally. On the condition that we are clear between us about what it is. It is not a gift. It is not a settlement. It is an introduction and a business courtesy that you have arranged on my family's behalf, and that I will repay through the income of my own work over time. She looked at him steadily. Those are my terms. He looked at her for a moment. Something in his expression moved. That was not a condition I proposed. No, but it is the one I need in order to accept. She kept her eyes on his. Can you agree to those terms? Yes, he said, immediately without the half-second calculation. Yes, I can. The afternoon stretched out between them in a way that was different from all their previous afternoons, which were not many, Eleanor reminded herself. They were not many, she was not allowed to lose track of how few they actually were. But different nonetheless. The tea went cold, and neither of them moved to refresh it. Outside, the summer afternoon did its ordinary things, and inside the parlor, the conversation moved through territory that was less fraught and more curious. He asked about the school, with the specificity of a man who is actually interested rather than performing interest, and she told him about the four women Dorothea had identified, about what she planned to teach them, about the particular gap she had noticed between what women in this city knew and what they needed to know to manage their actual lives. He listened the way she had rarely been listened to. Without the faint impatience that most men wore like a second coat, the readiness to interject, to redirect, to offer the solution before the problem was finished being described. You will need materials, he said when she paused. Account books. Paper. Ink. In quantity. I have thought about that. I have thought about that, she repeated with a slight emphasis. He stopped. A small battle crossed his face, the impulse to help against the condition she had laid down, and then he nodded. Once. All right. Thank you, she said. For not helping. For stopping when I asked you to. He looked at her. That should not require thanks. It usually does, she said quietly. In my experience, he was quiet for a moment. Then, with the careful weight of something he had been building toward, I want to ask you something. And I want you to know before I ask it that the answer, whatever the answer is, will not change. He stopped, reorganized. I am not asking this because of any of the other things. The Alcott arrangement, the school, any of it. I want to be clear about that. Eleanor set down her cup. Then ask,
she said. Would you be willing, would you consider?
He stopped again, and for the first time she saw him actually struggle with language, this man who had always seemed to have total command of every room he entered.
I would like to propose a different kind of arrangement, not...
He caught himself. Not a transaction. Not what was in Thornton's office. Something...
He looked at her with a directness that was almost painful in its lack of cover.
I would like to court you. Properly. If you are willing. With full knowledge of what that means, and does not mean no financial entanglement. No pressure toward any particular outcome.
No. I am not asking you to be anything other than what you are. I am asking if you are willing to let me come to know you.
More. As what I actually am, rather than what Thornton's office required me to be.
The room was very still. Eleanor looked at him at this sharp, guarded, imperfectly healing man who had just said in the most careful and least practiced language she had ever heard used for this purpose that he wanted to know her. She thought about Catherine, about what he had told her, about the 3 years of carrying something that had no resolution. She thought about the lease in her bag, about her mother who had been wasted on a smaller life, about herself standing on Chestnut Street in the summer heat with no money and a clean decision in her hands.
I have conditions, she said. He let out a breath. I would expect nothing less.
My school is not negotiable. My autonomy over it, the decisions about it, the direction of it is not subject to discussion or recommendation. It is mine.
Yes. If at any point this courtship begins to resemble an arrangement, I will say so, and we will stop.
Agreed.
And you will tell me the truth, about everything that is relevant. The way you told me about Catherine.
She paused.
I will not be in another situation where decisions are being made about me that I do not know about. If something concerns me, you will say it to me directly.
He held her gaze.
I will try.
I am not.
He paused.
I am not naturally given to, I do not communicate easily. I want to be honest about that.
I will try, and I will not always succeed. And I would prefer you tell me when I am failing, rather than conclude I am not trying.
Eleanor looked at him for a long moment. It was, she thought, the most honest pre-commitment to imperfection she had ever heard a man make.
All right, she said.
He blinked.
All right.
Yes. She picked up her cup cold now, but the gesture of it settled something.
You may court me, Mr. Ashford, on those terms.
She looked up.
And my first condition of the courtship is that you start calling me Eleanor. Because Mr. Ashford and Miss Whitmore have already been through rather a lot together, and the formality is beginning to feel theatrical.
He was quiet for a moment. Then, Nathaniel.
I know, she said. I have known your name for some time.
The almost laugh came again. Fuller this time. Almost actual. It changed his face completely. She had not been prepared for what his face did when something genuine moved through it, the way the sharp lines of it softened into something that was almost young, almost unguarded. She had not been prepared, and she made a note to be more prepared in future because she could not afford to be caught off guard by that face.
Not yet. Not until she had better footing.
She walked him to the door 20 minutes later. The afternoon had begun its long summer slide toward evening. He put on his hat on the front step and turned back to look at her.
The school, he said.
When does the first session begin?
3 weeks from Monday.
He nodded.
I will not come that day. I think you should have that day without...
He gestured slightly.
Without any of this. It should be yours.
Eleanor looked at him. She had not expected that either.
Thank you, she said, and meant it in a way that was different from the polite currency of thank yous, meant it in the way of a person who has been surprised by something and does not want to diminish the surprise by receiving it too quickly.
He nodded.
Left.
She stood in the doorway until the sound of his horse faded down the street, and then she went back inside and stood in the parlor alone. The lease was in her bag. 3 weeks until the school opened, 6 weeks until September, and the Hartley note, which was now manageable. A man had just sat in her parlor and asked to know her on terms that were hers,
and had agreed to all of them without negotiation, and had said he would not come on the first day of her school because that day should be hers. Eleanor stood in the parlor and breathed. Something was building. She could feel it not urgently, not with the pressure of something about to break, but with the steadier sensation of something taking shape, like the early framing of a structure that did not yet have walls, but that you could already see would be sound. She was not frightened of it. She had been frightened of the engagement. She had been frightened of the dissolution. She had been frightened of the parlor conversation on Thursday evening and the solicitor's desk on Friday morning. She had been frightened of all the things that had turned out to be survivable, and she was becoming, through the accumulated evidence of her own life, less afraid of things she could not yet fully see. What she was building on Market Street that was real. That was hers. What was building in this parlor in the conversations she had not expected with a man she had not expected to still be in her life, that was something else. Something without a name yet. Something she was willing for the first time in a long while to leave unnamed a little longer. She would meet it when it arrived. She went to her writing desk and opened a fresh sheet of paper, and she began drafting the curriculum for the first session of the Market Street School, and she did not stop until the candles burned low and the summer dark had fully settled outside and her hand ached pleasantly from the work. It was the best her hand had felt in a long time. He kept his word. On the Monday the school opened, Nathaniel did not come. Eleanor noticed his absence, the way you notice the absence of something you had not admitted to expecting. A small quiet awareness filed away without ceremony. She had six women in the Market Street room that morning. Six women who had come, some of them uncertainly. Some of them with the particular careful brightness of people trying not to look like they needed something they had needed for a long time. There was Mrs. Clara Fenwick, 34, whose husband managed a dry goods store and who had been signing documents she did not fully understand for 6 years. There was Miss Abigail Shore, 19, who was being prepared for a marriage her father was negotiating and who had come, Eleanor suspected, because she wanted to understand what she was being prepared for. There were four others each with their own quiet reasons, each carrying some version of the same thing, the specific weight of a capable mind that had been given nothing sufficient to do. Eleanor stood at the front of the room with a stack of account books and a piece of chalk, and she said, "We are going to start with contracts, what they are, what they require, and what you are entitled to understand before you sign one." Mrs. Fenwick made a sound that was not quite a laugh and not quite a cry and said, "Lord, I wish I had had this 10 years ago." "You have it now," Eleanor said. "That is what matters." She taught for 3 hours. When they filed out at midday, Abigail Shore stopped in the doorway and turned back and said with the directness of the very young, "Miss Whitmore, did you really refuse a settlement from Nathaniel Ashford?" Eleanor looked at her. "Where did you hear that?"
"Everyone knows,"
Abigail said simply.
"My mother said you were foolish. My aunt said you were brave."
A pause.
"I think you were brave. I wanted to say so."
She left before Eleanor could respond. Eleanor stood in the empty room and let that land. Then she picked up the chalk and began writing the next lesson's outline on the board, because there was work to do, and it was hers to do, and that was enough. Nathaniel came on Wednesday. He knocked at the Market Street door, rather than at her house on Walnut Street, which she thought was deliberate. He was drawing a line between the school and the courtship, keeping them in their separate territories the way she had asked him to. She appreciated the precision of it. She let him in. He looked at the room, the account books stacked along one wall, the chalk-covered board, the six chairs arranged in a loose arc rather than rows, and he was quiet for a moment. "How was Monday?" he asked.
"Good," she said.
"Better than good." She paused. Mrs. Fenwick cried when she successfully balanced a sample ledger. She was not embarrassed about it. I found it very... She stopped, because she did not have a word that was large enough for what she had found it.
"Yes," he said, as though she had finished the sentence.
"I imagine you did." They sat at two of the student chairs, slightly ridiculous. Both of them adult-sized people in chairs built for a different kind of meeting, and he told her about the conversation he'd had with Alcott, the final terms of the Hartley restructure, the paperwork that required her father's signature at the end of the week. Practical. Clear. He delivered information the way she had come to expect from him directly, without decoration, with the implicit assumption that she would understand it and could deal with it herself. She was beginning to think that assumption in him was its own form of respect. "There is something else," he said when the Alcott business was done. She heard the shift in his voice. Set down the ledger she had been holding. "My solicitor received a letter this week," he said, "from a man named Garrett. He was associated with my father's estate during the years before I inherited." He paused. "He is claiming that a portion of the coastal property the New England Holdings was subject to a prior agreement that my father entered into before his death. An agreement that was not disclosed in the estate transfer." Eleanor went still. "What kind of agreement?" "A loan arrangement, collateralized against the coastal land." He held her gaze. "If the claim is valid, it would affect approximately a third of the New England portfolio." She understood the weight of this. The New England Holdings were the most liquid part of his portfolio, the part most easily converted to income, the part that underwrote several of his other arrangements. A valid prior claim against a third of it would not ruin him, but it would significantly constrain him, and it would be a legal fight of considerable length and cost. "Is the claim valid?" she asked. "I don't know yet." His voice was even, but she could hear the effort of keeping it even. "Thornton is reviewing the documents. It may be nothing, a fraudulent claim, a misunderstanding, a piece of paper that doesn't hold up to scrutiny." He stopped. "Or it may not be nothing." "When will Thornton know?"
2 weeks, perhaps 3. She looked at him. He was sitting in one of her student chairs, with his hat on his knee, and his face carefully arranged, and she could see under the arrangement the specific quality of a man sitting with something he could not yet resolve. "Are you telling me this because it affects the courtship?" she asked. "Because the financial situation?"
"No."
The word was immediate and flat. "I am telling you because I said I would tell you things that were relevant. This is relevant, not because of money." He met her eyes. "Because I want you to know what I am dealing with. I do not want to be the kind of man who manages difficult things in private and only presents you with the resolved version." He paused. "I was that man once. I know what it costs." Eleanor looked at him for a long moment.
"All right," she said. "Then I will tell you something relevant too." She folded her hands on the account book in her lap. "I had a conversation with Abigail Shore on Monday. She said everyone in Philadelphia knows I refused your settlement. She said her mother called it foolish, and her aunt called it brave." She paused. "I have been thinking about which one it was."
"And both," she said.
"Probably."
She held his gaze. "I have also been thinking that the reason it felt necessary, the refusal, all of it, was not actually about pride. Or not only about pride. It was about needing to know I could. That I could walk away from the comfortable resolution. That I had not become the kind of person who takes the easy thing because the alternative is frightening." She paused. "I needed to know I was still capable of frightening myself." He was quiet.
"Are you," he asked, "still frightening yourself?"
"Every day," she said. "This school frightens me every day, in the best way."
Something moved in his face.
"Good," he said with that same surprising quality.
"You should be.
You said that before, about weeping. I mean it both times."
He looked at her.
"The things that frighten you are the right things to be doing."
She held that for a moment.
Then she said, "Tell me more about the Garrett claim. What exactly does his letter say?"
He told her. She listened the way Dorothea had taught her to listen for the structure of it, for what was being claimed and what was being implied, and where the seams were between documented fact and asserted interpretation. When he finished, she was quiet for a moment.
"Did your father keep correspondence?" she asked.
"Yes, extensively. It is in the Ashford Library."
"Have you searched it for anything related to a Garrett arrangement?"
He looked at her. Thornton suggested the same thing.
Then perhaps Thornton and I are both right.
She met his eyes.
Let me help.
He blinked.
With the correspondence.
I read contracts, I told you that.
I also read correspondence, and I am reasonably good at finding the thing that doesn't fit the letter that responds to something that should not have been sent the reference that appears once and is never explained.
She kept her voice matter-of-fact.
I am not your solicitor. I am not offering legal advice. I am offering another pair of eyes on a large amount of paper if you want them.
He looked at her for a long moment.
You would do that, he said. I just offered to.
I know, I am, yes.
He stopped.
Thank you.
Don't thank me yet. It may be several hundred letters.
It is almost certainly several hundred letters.
Then we should start soon, she said.
They started that Saturday.
The Ashford Library was large and organized in the way of a man who had valued information and had collected it without always finding time to sort it, which meant there was order, but it was the order of accumulation rather than design. Nathaniel had pulled the relevant years 1805 through 1812, the period of his father's late business activity and declining health, and stacked them on the main reading table.
Eleanor arrived at 10 in the morning. She sat across from Nathaniel at the reading table, with a stack of correspondence and a sheet of paper for notes, and they worked in a silence that was comfortable. In a way, she had not expected silence with him to be companionable rather than empty. Punctuated by the occasional question or observation, the kind of quiet that belongs to people doing a shared task and trusting each other with it. By noon, she had found three references to a man named Garrett. None of them were a loan arrangement. Two were payments for surveying work. One was a letter of introduction to a business contact in Boston. He was a surveyor, she said, not a lender.
Nathaniel looked up from his own stack.
Are you certain?
I am certain that these three letters describe him as one, and that the payments recorded here match surveying fees rather than loan repayments.
That is not the same as certain, but it is suggestive.
She slid the letters across.
What does Garrett's claim actually say, word for word?
Nathaniel retrieved the letter from his coat pocket. He had been carrying it, she noted.
She read it.
It took her 4 minutes. She read it twice, once for content, once for language.
This was written by a lawyer, she said.
Yes, a firm in Baltimore. A specific kind of lawyer.
She set it down.
The language here, prior interest collateralized against that, is very precise for a claim based on a private arrangement between individuals. It reads like someone with legal training constructed a claim around whatever documentation Garrett actually had, which may be limited.
She looked up.
He is not claiming he loaned your father money. He is claiming there was an agreement with implications of a lien. That is a weaker position dressed in stronger language.
Nathaniel stared at her.
How do you know that? He asked.
I read the dissolution agreement 3 times before I signed it, she said.
And the lease twice. And everything my father has put in front of me for the last 4 years.
She paused.
No one asked me to. I read things.
He was quiet.
Then,
Thornton has been practicing law for 20 years.
I know.
And Thornton will reach the same conclusion. I am simply reaching it faster.
She slid the Garrett letter back toward him.
Find the surveying contracts in your father's files. If Garrett was paid as a surveyor and is now claiming a lien interest, you have documentation showing the nature of the actual relationship. That is your counter.
He looked at her for a long moment, and in that moment, she saw something shift in his face that was different from all the previous shifts.
Not the almost laugh.
Not the careful warmth.
Something more fundamental.
The look of a man encountering something he had been missing without knowing he was missing it.
Eleanor, he said.
She looked up from the notes.
I need to tell you something, he said.
And I need you to... I am going to say it plainly the way you asked me to, and I need you to hear all of it before you respond.
Her pen stilled.
I entered the original arrangement with your father because I needed a wife in the social sense, an acceptable presence, a figure who would satisfy certain expectations and allow me to continue operating without the friction that comes from being an unmarried man of my position
and age. He held her gaze. I told you this before. What I did not tell you, what I did not understand until recently, is that I have been afraid. For 3 years. Of exactly what I asked you to allow me to do. Of knowing someone. Of being known. He paused. I told myself the Catherine situation had made me practical, that I had simply learned from it, become more sensible about what marriage was for. He stopped. I was not being practical. I was hiding. Eleanor did not speak. And then you walked into Thornton's office and refused to be managed and refused the money and refused to be invisible again. And I have spent 6 weeks. I have spent 6 weeks not being able to stop thinking about you and being in this room with you, watching you read a fraudulent legal claim and dismantle it in 4 minutes. He stopped. I am not. He looked at the table. I am not saying this correctly. You are saying it fine, she said quietly. He looked up. I am afraid, he said. I want to be clear about that. I am asking you to continue. To build whatever this is. And I am also afraid of it. Both things are true. Eleanor looked at him across the table covered in his father's papers. She thought about the first day of the school Mrs. Fenwick's face when the ledger balanced. She thought about standing in Thornton's office and pushing the envelope back across the desk and the 3 seconds on the sidewalk afterward when she had not known what she was anymore. She thought about her mother wasted on a smaller life and her own life not yet wasted, not yet decided, still in the process of being made. I am afraid too, she said. He blinked. Of what? Of exactly this, she said. Of letting someone matter to me again after learning how efficiently I can be unmattered. Of trusting that what I see in you is what is actually there and not what I want to see because I am... She stopped. I am lonely, Nathaniel. I want to say that plainly, the way you asked me to say things. I have been lonely for a long time, and lonely people are not always the most reliable judges of what they are encountering. He held her gaze. That is honest, he said. Yes. What do you do with it? The loneliness. I built a school, she said, and I am sitting in your library dismantling a fraudulent legal claim. She paused. And I am talking to you. That is what I am doing with it. He was quiet for a moment. Then he reached across the table, not for her hand, not dramatically, but for the Garrett letter, which was between them, and in reaching for it, his hand passed close enough to hers that she felt the warmth of it before he pulled back. It was nothing. It was not nothing. The surveying contracts, she said, steadying her voice. Where would your father have filed those? The cabinet against the east wall. 1807 through 1810, most likely. He stood. I will find them. He found them in 40 minutes. She had been right. Garrett had been paid as a surveyor on 3 separate occasions. There was no loan. There was no agreement. There was a man who had done work for the elder Ashford retained the correspondence and handed it to a creative lawyer in Baltimore who had constructed an argument out of proximity and implication. Thornton. When Nathaniel sent the surveying contracts to him that evening by messenger, wrote back within 2 hours. His response read, The claim will not survive scrutiny. I expect we can have it dismissed within a month. Where did you find these? Nathaniel wrote back, A colleague found them. He did not say more than that. But when he told Eleanor the next morning, standing in the Market Street doorway before her Wednesday students arrived, he said it with the particular quality of a man reporting a victory that did not entirely feel like his. Thornton says dismissed within a month, he said. Good, she said. You found it, he said. I want to be clear about that. She looked at him. We found it. You found the surveying contracts. After you told me where to look. Nathaniel. She held his gaze. Take the win. The claim is dismissed. That is the part that matters. He looked at her for a moment. Then the almost laugh came, and this time it was fully actual, a real sound quiet, but genuine the laugh of a man who has stopped fighting the thing that wants to come out. It was the second time she had been unprepared for his face. She was going to have to do better. 3 weeks after that, the school had 9 students. The Hartley note had been restructured and the first payment made without incident. Dorothea had sent a letter to 2 women she knew in New York, asking if they had heard of anything similar there. Eleanor's father had come to Market Street on a Tuesday afternoon unannounced, which made her tense when she saw him in the doorway and stood in the back of the room while she taught for 40 minutes and then left without saying anything. He said something that evening, at dinner, without looking up from his plate. "Mrs. Fenwick's husband came to see me," he said. Eleanor waited. He wanted to know, he said his wife had, that she had noticed a discrepancy in their store accounts that she had corrected. A significant one. He turned his fork over. He said she told him she had learned to spot it from your school. A pause. He was impressed. He wanted to know how to contact you about the next session. Eleanor set down her glass carefully. "I will write to him," she said. Her father nodded, said nothing else. But at the end of the meal, before he left the table, he looked at her with the tired, worn eyes that had looked at her on Thursday night 6 weeks ago, and said simply, "Your mother would have, yes. She would have." He left the room. Eleanor sat alone at the table for a moment. Then she went to write to Mrs. Fenwick's husband, and after that she went to write to Nathaniel, because she had begun doing that writing to him in the evenings. Brief letters, nothing formal. The kind of correspondence that belonged to people who had decided to know each other and were doing the work of it. And she told him about her father, and about Mrs. Fenwick, and about the letter to New York. His reply came the next morning. It said, "Your mother sounds like someone I would have liked to meet. I think she would have liked the school. I think she would have liked you." Eleanor read it twice. Then she folded it and put it in the locked drawer where she kept the things that mattered. There were 4 things in that drawer now. She added a 5th. The afternoon Nathaniel came to Market Street and stood in the doorway of the empty room the students had gone, she was cleaning the chalkboard and said without preamble, "I would like to ask you something, and I want you to know that the answer is not, I am not asking because of circumstances. I am not asking because of the Garrett claim or the school or what your father said. I am asking because of what happened in that library, and what happened before that in your parlor, and because I have run out of reasons to pretend I am not going to ask it." She put down the chalk. She turned. He was standing in her doorway. Her door. The door of the thing she had built, and his hat was in his hands, and his face was open, in a way she had only seen it be open twice before. And she understood that this was a moment that was going to matter in the way that only a handful of moments in a life actually matter. "Ask," she said. "Will you marry me?" he said. "Not as an arrangement, not as a transaction, as what I actually want, which is you, specifically, with the school and the locked drawer, and the way you read contracts, and the way you told me my face showed things I didn't know it was showing." He stopped. "Will you marry me on terms that are yours? Whatever they are, I will agree to them." The room was very quiet. Eleanor looked at him. She thought about the girl she had been in Thornton's office, the one who had pushed back an envelope stuffed with money, and walked out into the Philadelphia summer with nothing but the decision itself. She thought about what that girl had been afraid of, and what she had not been afraid of, and what she had built in the space between. She thought about Catherine, who had never been known, and about her mother, who had never been allowed to build. She thought about Nathaniel Ashford standing in the doorway of her school with his hat in his hands, asking her on her terms, having agreed to every condition she had ever set, having come back every time she left room for him to come back. "Yes," she said. He let out a breath. "Yes," she said again, more firmly, because it deserved to be said twice. "On my terms, which include the school remaining mine, my income remaining mine, my decisions remaining mine, and you continuing to tell me the truth about difficult things, even when it would be easier not to." "Yes to all of it," he said. "All of it." She crossed the room. He did not move to meet her. He let her come to him, which she recognized as its own kind of respect, letting her choose the distance, and she stopped in front of him and looked up at his face, that sharp and newly open face, and she said, "I am not choosing escape. I want you to know that.
I am not marrying you because my situation required it, or because it was the sensible resolution. I am choosing this. She held his gaze. I am choosing you. With clear eyes. That is different.
I know, he said. That is why I asked.
He reached up and touched her face one hand, careful. The way you handle something, you understand the value of. And she felt the warmth of it go all the way through her, and she let it. They stood in the doorway of her school in the August afternoon in Philadelphia in the summer of 1817, and they did not make speeches or promises that exceeded what they could actually keep. What they made was a choice. Hers, freely given. His, honestly asked for. And in a world that had spent 22 years telling Eleanor Whitmore that her choices were not hers to make, that was not a small thing. That was everything.